It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
So for anybody that's listening to this that is for some reason unfamiliar with your work, you just want to introduce yourself real quick and also just talk about how you got started as an artist and maybe some other major works that people should check out.
Okay, sure. My name is Gordon Hill. I'm from the Kwakwaka'wakw Nation, an indigenous nation on the Pacific Northwest Coast. I've been doing art pretty much all my life since I was a little kid. I think in the late 1990s, I started working on comics. I've been doing graphic art and traditional artwork like carving and stuff like that. But in the late 90s, I started working on comics. And I produced a bunch of comics that were just like leaflets I designed for a handout at conferences and stuff like that, or gatherings. After a while, I had a compilation of those. So those were brought down to Arsenal Pulp Press in Vancouver, and they published my first comic, which was the 500 Years of Indigenous Resistance comic book. And then a year later, they wanted another comic book because of the anti-Olympic, the 2010 Olympics in Vancouver and the G20 summit in Toronto. In 2010, they wanted a comic that was going to look at those kind of struggles. So then I produced the anti-capitalist resistance comic book. Last year they wanted me to do an anti-fascist comic book because of the rise of fascist and neo-Nazi groups in North America, and particularly after the Charlottesville Unite the Right rally where Heather Heyer was killed by the neo-Nazi. So they wanted me to do an anti-fascist comic book. Yeah,
and also just throw in there the 500 Years of Indigenous Resistance is also a really pivotal work to check out, too. If people have not read that, that's mostly just text, and you can – I think the newest version is published off of PM Press.
Yeah, there was a text version it's basically titled 500 Years of Indigenous Resistance, which I wrote in the early 90s, and it's been published as a zine, but then, yeah, PM Press published it as a book. So it's like a text, it's all text pretty much. And the 500 Years of Resistance comic book is, it's a little different because it just kind of focuses on different indigenous nations' resistance to European colonialism. So they're kind of like little snapshots. They're fairly brief, like maybe 3 to 4 pages each. And just to kind of like give an overview of indigenous resistance as opposed to the kind of the colonial narrative of native peoples were just like helpless victims of European genocide. And that doesn't really inspire resistance in today's generations or whatever. So I wanted to really highlight the resistance that occurred. So that was the main purpose of the comic book.
Right. Yeah, and we highly recommend people checking out all of your work, especially there's quite a few kind of like tactical manuals and like organizing guides and stuff like that, which are really fabulous, and people, if they can, should track those down and read them and study them as best they can.
Yeah, those ones are you can access those on a website I run, warriorpublications.wordpress.com, and there's a lot of the manuals, counter surveillance, security, and how to defend territories and stuff like that.
So what drew you to make this new graphic novel about fascism and anti-fascism? You said that it was after Charlottesville that the people at Arsenal Press were hitting you up about it. Is this something that you were already thinking about as well, or this was kind of at the request of your publishers?
Yeah, at the request of the publishers. I mean, I hadn't thought about doing an anti-fascist comic book, but I was following what was going on because I was involved in anti-fascist work in the 1990s. And so I was following the new developments, you know, Trump's election and then all these little fascist groups arising and whatnot. So I was aware of what was going on. And when they asked me if I would be interested in doing an Antifa comic book, I was like, definitely. I said, yes, I'd love to do that. And so it took a lot of work, though, because they wanted it published very quickly. They wanted it published in the spring, actually, but that would have been impossible. So, yeah, I worked for many months, like, at the research and then, you know, do the artwork and the script and all this stuff. So it was kind of a quick turnaround from when they asked me to actually having finished it. It took about 7 or 8 months of work. But yeah, I'm pretty happy with the work they did on it. Well, they're really supportive. They're a pretty radical publisher. They're based in Vancouver. So yeah, I'm pretty happy with it. And I mean, I had done some small comics about Antifa. They're very short little comics, but this was definitely a better opportunity to really give an overview of anti-fascist resistance from the last 100 years, basically, and also give an overview of the rise of fascist movements and the kind of social conditions that they found most successful, such as Italy and Germany. And then the book goes up to more current times, like up till Charlottesville. So yeah, and there's a lot of the anti-fascist groups I wanted to cover, but there wasn't really enough time or space to. But it's basically an overview of anti-fascist resistance over the last century.
Yeah, we're going to get into all that in a second. But I mean, for anybody that hasn't been able to get their hands on your work, I mean, you really take, you know, massive amounts of historical information, and I wouldn't say simplify them, but, you know, kind of boil them down into kind of easy to understand, you know, comic book form. But at the same time, it doesn't lose any of the potencies in terms of analysis or just kind of an understanding of, you know, the major forces at work. But I'm curious, when you were writing and researching for the project, did anything jump at you or surprise you in terms of the history of fascism or anti-fascism that maybe before doing this project that you may have not thought about?
Well, definitely. I learned a lot. Like Italy, I started with Italy because that's where the first fascist movement, the first successful fascist movement arose, and it inspired all the other fascist movements that came after it. So I learned a lot from Italy in terms of like the type of resistance that there was, anti-fascist resistance, the armed resistance from the RDT del Popolo, which was one of the main armed anti-fascist grouping, and just like how things developed in Italy and the relationship with the Social Democrats, the Italian Socialist Party, and how they kind of sabotaged the armed resistance and just all this type of stuff. Like that, to me, that was really illuminating, and I learned a lot from it, and you can apply a lot of lessons learned from like Italy to today. You have similar discussions going on about how to respond to fascist movements and stuff like this. I mean, I think what big difference is that you don't really have a big socialist party that's kind of dominating the anti-fascist resistance in North America. So there's a lot of parallels, but there's a lot of differences, of course. But yeah, certainly Italy, I learned a lot. Also during the World War II, the level of partisan anti-fascist resistance across Europe, across Nazi-occupied Europe, I mean, that was pretty inspiring as well. And some of the other stuff, like going through history, like what happened in Britain with the black shirts, and yeah, I definitely learned a lot, and it's an inspiring history as far as I'm concerned in terms of anti-fascist resistance, because you always have this thing like the fascist movements are rising and they're very powerful and omnipotent, but the type of resistance that there was actually pretty inspiring. I think it's an important history to know about.
Yeah, this isn't in our questions, but there's been a debate over the years. Like, for instance, Daniel Goran wrote a book called like Fascism and Big Business. I think that the argument was that you know, capitalism degenerates to the point where fascism is needed to protect it, whereas like others have argued in books like Discussion Documents for a Militant Movement Confronting Fascism that at the same time fascism was still at times quasi anti-capitalist, that you know, sought to kind of like outflank the left and critique both, you know, the what they like the Nazis called you know, the bourgeois socialism and caviar capitalism. And I'm just kind of curious, in your estimation, what really led to the rise of fascism?
I think it was definitely the social conditions after World War One. That's when these fascist movements arose, and it was, in Italy, you had, you know, the economy was, had been really downgraded as a result of the war. They suffered a lot of casualties, and then he had a large amount of demobilized soldiers because the army didn't need, 3 million or whatever soldiers. So, millions of soldiers were let go from the army, and then they're unemployed workers now, basically. And so there's a lot of poverty going on, and then there's a lot of resentment against the government for in terms of Italy, like the Treaty of Paris or whatever. The end result of World War One, Italy didn't get what it wanted, and a lot of the population saw it was as a betrayal by this weak government. And so that fed into the rise of a fascist movement led by Mussolini, who's their main intellectual. A similar thing happened in Germany too after World War One. You know, Germany is hit with the conditions of the Treaty of Versailles. And they have massive unemployment and poverty, and then millions of soldiers are demobilized. And so in both Italy and Germany, you have all these veterans who form basically militias. And you have, there's hundreds of thousands of ex-soldiers who end up joining these militias, and they're generally right-wing conservative and very vulnerable to the fascist message. So when you look at that history, it's these fascist movements, they rise more or less autonomously from a far-right grouping or movement, but they receive support from the bourgeoisie, from some elements of the bourgeoisie. Like Mussolini was getting support from arms manufacturers and banks involved in the weapons production, funding for weapons production and stuff like that. So there's elements of the ruling class that support the fascist rise, but there's within the ruling class, you have elements that they don't really see the fascists as a good, viable alternative. But when they're faced with the rise of a really strong left, a revolutionary left movement, they will side with the fascists. And that's what happened in Italy and Germany, because the bourgeoisie and the middle class fear what they see as a communist revolution, on the verge of breaking loose in their country. So they become more reactionary, and they support and join the fascist movements. So I think there's truth in both those arguments, it's a tool used by big business to smash communist revolution. There's no doubt about that. But at the same time, these types of movements arise autonomously from within elements of the population. And in terms of Italy and Germany, that was primarily the demobilized soldiers. There was one philosopher, and I wanted to include his quote in the book. I never got a chance to. I forget what his name is, but he summed up fascism as basically the militarization of politics. And that's partly because its origin comes from this very large soldier-military context. That would be my response. It's both big business and it's an autonomous movement that arises as well.
Yeah. Just one other aside question you brought up, and this has been talked about, time and time again, especially in the United States, with people kind of pushing back on like centrist kind of hand-wringing against Antifa. But how did like the big socialist parties and like the social democrats, how did they react to communist, anarchist, and socialist kind of autonomous initiatives to really smash the fascists off the streets? And how did they kind of like undermine that resistance?
Well, in Italy, you had the armed anti-fascist groupings in the Arditi del Popolo, which was an armed formation of communists, anarchists, socialists, and whatnot. I mean, the Italian Socialist Party banned all members from taking part in the RDD. And their reasoning was they didn't want their members being infected with, you know, other leftist ideologies like communists and anarchists and whatnot. And they were also maneuvering because they're trying to get a place in government. So they're maneuvering. They were actually negotiating with the fascists. And at one point they came to a, like they made a peace treaty with the fascists, which the fascists, you know, didn't really follow. But so the Italian Socialist Party was one of the main targets of the fascists, and they were completely unprepared for the fascist offensive that occurred after 1919, 1920, 1921. You know, the fascists just smashed the Socialist Party. They destroyed their offices, their newspapers, their clubs, and then they attacked union halls and all this type of stuff. So they were very unprepared for it because they had, they just had this thing of like, they got to maintain their legal position, their, and so they followed a very legalistic anti-fascist policy, and it was all because they were trying to maneuver to get into government. And the other groups like anarchists and communists broke away from the Socialist Party, but they were more interested in fighting fascists in the streets because, you know, anarchists aren't trying to gain political power through the government, and the communists were trying to overthrow the government, so we had these different ideologies working. But yeah, I mean, that's how the Socialist Party in Italy kind of sabotaged the anti-fascist resistance, because they basically, they were trying to get a position in the government. And similarly, in Germany, you have kind of a similar situation, but you have a very large German Communist Party and a very large also German Socialist Party. And so they were both competing with one another. Then, of course, Stalin came out with the new line that the Social Democrats were also fascists, and so they had to be fought first, which was dictated through the Communist International, which was like, you know, they funded a lot of the communist parties all through Europe from Soviet Russia. So that was how that anti-fascist resistance in Germany was kind of sabotaged by the communist party's hard line against the Social Democrats. Although, on the other hand, the Social Democrats, you know, when they were in power in various times, they were the ones who carried out, you know, the deadly repression of workers' uprisings and communist protests and stuff. It was the socialist government, you know, state or city governments that were doing the repressing of that. So it's kind of understandable that you would have this type of division arising. But I think certainly from learning from history, like, we wouldn't want to get into a position like that. But then again, it's at different times now. And, you know, in North America particularly, you just don't have a communist party or a socialist party that can kind of, you know, dominate, you know, how the anti-fascist resistance is going to proceed. So you have a much more autonomous type of movement that's, you know, has occurred here. Yeah.
Just kind of switching gears here. How would you compare, you know, like you were talking about, you know, the social conditions, the fact that there were like strong revolutionary movements in Italy and in Germany. I mean, Germany went through a period of near revolution. In Italy, there were massive factory occupations and just like massive amounts of working class resistance in the late teens and early 20s. But how would you compare just the conditions that led to the growth of fascism in Europe to today across the world? Are there similarities, or is it just too different to really compare them too much?
Conditions are quite different because also in Italy and Germany, because you had such a strong revolutionary left, the fascist movement really grew in part because of the threat that was seen from the revolutionary left. And that's when they started getting a lot of funding from elements of the ruling class who saw the danger from the left. So they were like, we want to start funding these fascist paramilitary groups to smash the left. And that's basically what happened. Because you wouldn't have had a strong fascist movement if there hadn't been a strong revolutionary movement. Because in Italy you had, which was just like this really strong expansion and activity coming from the revolutionary left after World War One, you know, where you know, like you mentioned, all the factory occupations. I mean, they were taking over entire towns and municipalities, and that were coming under socialist leftist control. And that's what the response. A lot of the fascist paramilitary were based in the rural areas, and they were organized by local landowners and local, you know, petty bourgeoisie, and that, and comprised a lot of times of these middle class elements. So they joined the fascist movement in reaction to the strength of the revolutionary left. And the same in Germany, like you mentioned, you had almost a revolution and after World War One, and you had the Spartacist uprising, which was the Communist Party, uprisings occurring, and just a lot of like revolutionary activity going on. And that's what, the fascist party, the Nazi party was able to exploit that and, you know, fear monger among the middle class who ended up, joining the Nazi party in very large numbers. And then they started getting more support from members of the ruling class as well. So today you have very different social conditions. You could say there's some similarities in terms of like, you have an economy that's it's not stagnant, but it's there's definitely a widespread poverty and whatnot. But in North America, you just have very, very different social conditions. Also, in terms of the population, like Germany and Italy were fairly homogeneous, white Germans, but in North America, you have it's a much more diverse population. With, you got a large African American populations, you got large Mexican immigrants from Central and South America make up a large percentage of the population in the U.S. So you have very different dynamics in terms of that as well. And that might, and that is something like Proud Boys might be an indication of more of the potential fascist threat you can see, where it's a little bit more multinational. It's not just like a white supremacist thing, it's also like drawing in some people of color into their movement. So they're going to have very different dynamics, I think, than Italy and Germany in the 1920s and 1930s. And then you also have, for the anti-fascists, you also have the history that you can look back on. And, I think there's a very strong thing in the anti-fascist resistance. It's like, never again, like, don't let the fascists take the streets. Like, that was one of the main lessons maybe learned from Nazi Germany, certainly, is like, you don't let the fascists organize and become a major threat. You want to fight them and confront them when they're still a small, kind of marginal threat, which is the case now. So I think, that type of stuff makes it very different. Fascists, the thing about fascist movements I find is like, because they're ultra-nationalistic, their fascist ideology, it differs from country to country because of this ultra-nationalism and the culture and the history of each nation state. So the Italian fascists, for example, were different than the German Nazis. If the Italian fascists, like, anti-Semitism wasn't a big deal to them.
Right.
But it was to Nazi Germany. Then when Nazi Germany was kind of dominating the Axis powers and that, and dictating how they should proceed, then Italy in the mid-30s, then they adopted some anti-Semitic laws, but it was never to the degree that Nazi Germany was doing, because anti-Semitism was the basis of their ideology. So those types of differences you have arise because of the different national social conditions. So that's why fascism, it takes many different forms. There's always the debate about, it's so hard to define fascism because it takes on all these different things. Because you have some fascist groups, they're not that anti-Semitic, but they might be like really anti-Catholic or something. But then you have other fascist groups that are Catholic, basically, like fascist clergy groups, kind of, you know what I mean? Like, there's just a lot of differences that can arise. So it's always, it's hard to compare, say these conditions today are the same as, in the past, and you have, the potential to rise of a fascist movement. It's like the social conditions can be different, but you still have the potential for fascist movements to arise, like what happened with the East Bloc. When the East Bloc collapsed, you had an explosion of far-right nationalist and fascist movements. I mean, today Russia probably has the biggest, today Russia has the largest white supremacist fascist movements in the world. And they were a former communist, country. So it varies a lot from country to country.
Well, thinking about, the United States, I mean, one of the things that you said really resonated was just like all these kind of like, both out of work and like declassed former military men that are kind of sitting around and are kind of like waiting on the state to call on them to kind of defend the homeland, or, you know, in the case of the United States, to defend whiteness and the territory from some sort of outside force. And I think that's such a huge thing that animates people's drive to the far right. And I think that there is, like some of the things you outlined, like people talk a lot about like the three factors of fascism, one being like a supportive set of people from the bourgeoisie that are supplying money, one being kind of like a disaffected middle class, and then the other being like the active fascist agents and groups that are all, but they're, you know, all those kind of factors are needed to kind of like push a fascist movement really into something beyond just like ideas or something like that. But it does seem like we're seeing that across, you know, across the world for sure.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in the States and to some degree in Canada, the militia movement, I mean, that has a lot of potential. I mean, it's existed for a couple of decades now in the States. And that type of movement has a lot of potential because you also, you know, the United States has been at war since 2001, invasion of Afghanistan. And so you have, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of veterans now. And, you know, there's a percentage of those that have joined militias. And the thing about the militias, you also have a little bit of diversity there, because some of them are like, we're here to defend the Constitution or whatever. And then some militias are more like, the government is corrupt and you have the more fascist elements in the militia movement, which are like, the government is, you know, it's controlled by Jews and all this type of stuff. So you have a kind of a split in the militia thing where some are like, we're going to support we support the government and the constitutional rights or whatever. And then other elements of the militia are like, well, the government is our enemy and, you know, we have to prepare to fight this government and the UN occupation that, you know, other conspiracy theories talk about. But I mean, that is a danger in the States right now, is that you have all these militia groups that are kind of there, but they're not really unified. I mean, I think two of the largest are the Oath Keepers and the Three Percenters.
Right.
And their politics, you know, they're kind of vague about what they're about, and the officials are always trying to portray them as, we're just a self-defense force and we're here to protect the Constitution and, you know, all that type of stuff. But that is a danger you have in the States, especially because you do, you know, there are all these veterans and all these militia groups that they can join, and you can see that the militias obviously sympathize and, you know, at times work with far right and fascist groups. You know, we saw that in Charlottesville at the Unite the Right rally and at other rallies across the country where you have Three Percenters providing armed security for far right fascist rallies and stuff like that. So that's a danger you have. And then the most recent thing was the Oath Keepers offering a training for their Spartan training or whatever they call it. For fighting Antifa.
Right.
So you have these things that are developing, you know, and I think a lot of people can see the potential dangers of all this stuff that's, you know, that's kind of in the works here.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, for anarchists, for anti-capitalists, anti-colonials, when we look back on these struggles that are outlined in your book, whether it's like Revolutionary Spain or you know, the fight against fascism in Italy and Germany. I mean, these also were lessons in defeat too. So I'm curious, you know, looking back at these experiences, what would you say the big lessons are for anti-capitalists and, you know, in terms of historical examples that came out of, you know, essentially what was, for at least for a while, a victory for fascism?
Well, I think certainly there's a need for a physical resistance. I think that's a very important aspect of it. If the Italian Socialist Party hadn't kind of sabotaged the armed resistance, I mean, Italy could have actually turned into a very different type of situation without a fascist regime taking power, because the government was very weak. And, you know, the Mussolini's March on Rome, you know, the celebrated March on Rome was just like, it was just like political theater. Like, the fascists didn't actually pose a military threat to the regime. The regime was just so weak, it buckled and basically brought Mussolini into the government. But if there had been a stronger resistance from the left, I mean, that could have been stopped. I think also during World War II, I think it was Yugoslavia basically liberated itself from Nazi occupation. So it wasn't just like the Western imperial powers, you know, smashed Nazi Germany, because all through Nazi-occupied Europe, there was like very strong partisan resistance and whatnot. And in some areas, they were able to create liberated zones and whatnot. So that goes back to, you have to have like a strong physical resistance, because like that quote that I brought up, fascism is the militarization of politics. And if that's true, then you have to have a military response, even if it's just on the sense of having a self-defense, defend yourself. Because we know what the end goal or the ultimate goal of the fascists is. I mean, they boast about it all the time. Like in the States, you have this thing of like the helicopter ride, like, which is a threat, right? Once we take power, we're gonna liquidate, we're gonna kill all leftists and anti-fascists, and, you know, which is what happened in Germany. You know, the first targets of, once the Nazis took power, was the Communist Party. That was the main political opposition. And then after that, it was, you know, the trade unions and, you know, then the Jews and this type of stuff. But the main opponent of the fascists is going to be their first target. And that, you know, that's why you need to have a physical resistance. And I think just having like a broad-based anti-fascist movement is important as well. And I mean, I think like Britain is a really, I mean, they're kind of in a bad situation now, but Britain, the anti-fascist action in Britain, you know, they were very successful during the 80s and into the early 90s and that, in terms of how they organized, and they basically defeated the fascists on the streets. And that's when the fascists withdrew from any kind of street activities and just started focusing on electoral politics and started having some victories in that. And that left anti-fascist action was unable to respond, because they're not into electoral politics. That's not their thing. They were there to physically confront them on the street. So that's another thing to, you know, to think about. It's like, if you drive the fascists from the streets and then they turn to a purely electoral strategy, like, how do you respond to that type of thing? But I mean, I thought that would be getting ahead of ourselves, because right now the main thing is like confronting them on the streets, especially on the West Coast. You can see, like, I mean, it seems like their street mobilizing has kind of died down throughout a lot of the country, except on the West Coast and, you know, up in the Washington and Oregon, you've had a fairly strong showings from the Proud Boys and Patriot Prayer, which is, I think, is a little bit different than what's happening in the rest of the country. But, I mean, certainly from history, like, you have to have a physical resistance, and I would say you have to have an armed resistance as well, because the fascists are armed. We talked about the militias. Those are armed groups. They're preparing for some kind of civil war. Some of them are preparing for race war. Their fantasy is to go out and carry out massacres of, you know, people that they see as subhuman or whatever. So that's a reality that people should prepare for it and keep in mind, because all you need is, like, you know, some serious systemic crises, and these types of fascist groups could really flourish and take over areas of the country, you know, where they're kind of based now. So there's definitely it's definitely a dangerous time, and there's a real importance for people to be vigilant and prepared. Yeah.
Lavoratori e studenti si incantano, volano bulloni e stanchi e trini. Hey!
You know, I wanted to ask, you know, so much of your past work has been on colonization and indigenous resistance to it. What do you see as like kind of the crossover or, you know, how has the legacy and continuation of colonialism impacted and influenced far-right movements in the so-called Americas, would you say?
Well, I mean, I would go back to Europe and look at Italy. I mean, Italy with the fascist movement, but Italy also being a colonial power, you know, they were involved in North Africa, in Ethiopia and Somalia and all that. And the same with Germany. I mean, they were a colonial power. They had colonies in Africa and that. And there's, I mean, I didn't get too into it. I didn't really have the time or energy or whatever because I was just trying to really focus on anti-fascist history, fascist movements and stuff. But, I mean, within the colonialism, imperialism, definitely contributed to the rise of fascist movements. And Mussolini, for example, they were basically looking at the renewal of the Roman Empire, and that's partly why their colonial activities in North Africa became really important in the 30s. But I mean, that's kind of the thing of the fascist thing. It's like they want to build a fascist empire, and that's the same what Germany did, was they were basically colonizing Europe to become part of a Nazi regime. So, you know, the invasion of Eastern Europe, I mean, that was all, you know, the Lebensraum, whatever, the living space thing that the Nazis promoted, that Hitler promoted. It's like, we need more living space. We'll take the lands of the Slavic peoples, their subhuman peoples, we'll work them to death as slaves, and we'll take all their resources. So colonialism is definitely a part of the fascist world vision, because everybody else besides your Aryan people are subhumans to be colonized and eventually exterminated. So there's definitely parallels in it. I mean, fascism is, perhaps in a sense, a type of colonization. Definitely arises from colonization, from the ideology of colonialism. But yeah, I mean, I wasn't really able to get into that with the comic because I had kind of limited time and limited space to work with.
But. Sure. Well, I wanted to turn now to the Canadian state, and there are, you know, developing kind of like Trumpian type movements and politicians, and obviously there's a lot of like street movements that are, if they're not outwardly white nationalists, they're very against immigrants and people in the Muslim community. I'm just kind of curious your analysis of kind of what's driving these far-right segments in so-called Canadian society.
Well, I think Canada is like very influenced by what happens in the U.S. So far-right groups up here, like when there's a resurgence of the far-right in the U.S., it'll happen in Canada as well, because they're inspired, right? And they think there's more potential to work, especially with Trump getting elected. We saw a big resurgence of far-right fascist groups here in the country. The other thing is, like, and one thing that's always kind of motivated far-right fascist groups in the, you know, in the KKK is immigration. Like, it's always been a big issue. It's one of the main things that really gave rise to far-right movements. I mean, outside of Italy and Germany and, you know, pre-World War II, after World War II, one of the main motivators, instigators of far-right expansion is immigration. So through the 70s, you had the National Front in Britain. And that became a big movement because of immigration. And it's the same happening today in Europe, as you have a lot of immigration. You know, they're bringing in tens of thousands of refugees from Syria. And that's being a catalyst for a lot of the far-right mobilizing, because they're exploiting it. And any little incident, you know, they try to make it a bigger thing and rally the population against immigrants. And that's partly happening in Canada, too. I mean, Canada has a lot of immigrant peoples. And it's a fairly diverse country in a sense, but because of the controversy about immigration in the U.S. and Europe, that's inspiring people in Canada as well, the far right in Canada, to adopt, you know, anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim positions. So we've had similar things here with similar groups here organizing that their main thing is anti-Muslim. And then we had the massacre in Quebec City where that guy went into a mosque and he shot and killed six people. And that's, you know, that's kind of like the effect of what's happened in the U.S. to a large degree, like that, because that really motivates the far right here.
Yeah. Like the person that carried that out, I mean, there's pictures of him wearing Trump hats. I mean, I think Ben Shapiro was one of his favorite, you know, far right speakers, and he's not even considered alt right. You know, he's just, you know, kind of like far right. You know, you mentioned in the U.S., like, pushing them off the streets. It does seem that the, like, alt-right activity is kind of waning. But at the same time, like, in the U.S. in the past month, there's been somebody in the Department of Homeland Security that's been fired for sending emails to various prominent white nationalists. He obviously had a connection. He actually came through a group called FAIR, which is Federation for Immigration Reform, which is kind of like a suit and tie white nationalist group. And they have various people in the Trump administration that are tied to them, even people like Kellyanne Conway, which is kind of the public face of the Trump organization, has ties to FAIR. But also, a couple weeks ago, one of Trump's speechwriters was fired because it turned out that he had spoken at a white nationalist conference with Richard Spencer. So I'm just curious, from your perspective, I mean, like, this is something that we've talked about a lot as well. Like, when you have people within the government that are obviously tied to creating a lot of these, you know, anti-immigration policies and things like the Muslim ban, how should autonomous social movements kind of address this?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I think one step is to expose these who these people are, like, just educate, you know, public education about who these people are that are in power. I mean, you had Steve Bannon, who is no longer in the Trump regime, but I mean, he was like one of the leading far right intellectuals of the alt right as well. And, you know, today he's like going over to Europe and he's like organizing the National Front and the Alternative for Germany and all these far right crypto fascist groups. I mean, I think the one thing about the Trump regime, I think a lot of people kind of understand that, you know, he's a racist and he's got a lot of white nationalist people in his regime, in his administration. Because of the situation in the States, I mean, you basically have an anti-Trump position that you kind of need to, like, promote, I think, because of the way that his administration is set up with all these, like, white power, you know, fascist people in it, and their policies that they're doing, you know, they kind of like infiltrated the government institutions now through Trump. So, I mean, that's one thing. I mean, you also have like ongoing campaigns against ICE. I mean, that's how an autonomous movement responds. Like,
right.
they're trying to defend the immigrant populations. That's one aspect of it. Public education, exposing who these people are in the regime, confronting them on the streets when they try to mobilize. So I think all these things are happening, and you know, you have a fairly vibrant movement in the States from what I can see, and a lot of it's been energized by Trump becoming president. So you have a much more active social movements there, and the thing, a lot of people they're just learning about these things too. You know, I think you have a lot of new people that have joined into this kind of resistance social movement. So it's, in some sense, it's kind of young and it's kind of growing and learning. So I think those are very positive aspects of it. The other thing I would mention, like, you know, previously, you just never really saw neo-Nazi movements arise in the States or in Canada, because the Nazi thing was seen as such a bad thing. You'd never come out and say, I'm a Nazi,
right,
and expect to get anywhere. And that's why, like, even in the 80s and the 90s, when there was anti-racist action and they were confronting, you know, the Ku Klux Klan or these neo-Nazi skinhead groups and that type of stuff, I mean, there was discussion about, you know, what should we call ourselves? Because there was Antifa groups in Europe, but in North America, people adopted anti-racist action because the idea of fascism was so remote. No, you know, a lot of people would be like, anti-fascist action, like, what fascists are there? And you might be hard, have a hard time to explain, like, what fascist groups are there in North America at that time. I mean, there were some, but they're very, very small, like National Vanguard or some weird little groups that no one really ever saw. But now you have, you know, you've seen a big rise in fascist groups and stuff like that. So now you can talk about anti-fascism and anti-fascist action and stuff like that. So that's a big change from the 90s, where you still had, you know, a lot of white supremacist groups running around and, you know, committing assaults and murders and arsons and bombings, which is what, you know, same situation today. But now they're actually, you know, you have a lot more that are kind of explicitly fascist groups and right. stuff like that. And that's arising from the Trump regime, I think. You know, the Trump regime really helped legitimize the far right and shift the far right even further to the right, so that there's room for these little fascist groups to pop up now.
Or to just say that, like, as Gorka would say, like, you know, there's no such thing as far-right violence. They're not carrying out bombings. This is all false flag by the left or by people that want to make Trump look bad, or, you know, just really batshit crazy stuff. But, I mean, you know, a lot of people bought it. You know, a lot of...
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy to see the discussion coming out of the States about, like, oh, Antifa violence and stuff like that. But, I mean, in the last couple of years, it's been, like, 100 people have been murdered by far-right and fascist individuals.
You have
middle class, whatever, they want to talk about Antifa violence. It's just so preposterous. But that's because I think, you know, they are reactionaries. They are right-wing conservatives, and they're trying to, use the Antifa militancy as a thing to attack the left. Because they're, you know, they're right wing and they're probably fascist sympathizers when it comes down to it. They would rather see fascists marching in the streets than Antifa.
Right.
Just like in Germany and Italy, where you had elements of the bourgeoisie who would rather see fascists marching through Rome or Berlin than to see the communist hordes, you know, coming through. So,
right.
Because, I mean, in the States, it's so ridiculous, like how... You know, Black Lives Matter, do some protests, they block some highways type of stuff. And then you have petitions with tens of thousands of signatures calling for Black Lives Matter to be labeled a terrorist organization. It's just so preposterous. But that's the reactionary, right-wing, white supremacist reality of the United States. I mean, it's just similar in Canada, but we have different dynamics going on here. But so this, the whole thing with the violence, it's just so ridiculous. Like, but I mean, that's the right wing ideology, though. You know, they're not really looking at facts. The facts they're presented with that they don't like, it becomes fake news. It's just like this weird mind, this weird mental gymnastics and stuff that they do to maintain, you know, what they think is correct, their correct ideology or whatever. It's just ridiculous.
Right. Well, just a few more questions. You know, one thing I wanted to ask, in the past couple of weeks, it's coming out in the Washington Post and a couple other places that in certain parts of Texas, the government has started to basically delete or get rid of birth records of people that they claim that they suspect of engaging or their parents engaged in birth certificate fraud. So like in certain places in Texas where it's largely Latino people, largely small pockets of, you know, historically voting Democratic voters, they're just, you know, getting rid of these people's records. And if they like go into Mexico to visit family and come back, they're finding out that they're no longer U.S. citizens, and they're thrown into detention facilities. And like, it's even gotten to the point where Bank of America has started to freeze people's accounts that they think are, you know, fake citizens and stuff like that. And I think this kind of flies in the face of things like the Muslim ban or the child separation stuff, where it's kind of like announced ahead of time. And it's basically kind of, it almost seemed like Trump like showing his middle finger to the rest of the country. And there was like wide outspread reaction, you know, like people on the streets immediately. Whereas something like this is like much more quiet. It's not being announced. It's kind of a small thing. It reminds me somewhat of kind of the things the Nazis did, where they would like start different campaigns against Jews, or they would have soldiers go out and like, you know, put like, you know, Juden on certain stores, and just to kind of see how the rest of the population would respond. And I'm just kind of curious your thoughts on that. Kind of like, what are some things that we should be looking out for, like that are really huge warning signs that like, you know, shit could get a lot worse very quickly.
Some of the actions of the Trump regime are definitely exactly like that. Like they're from the Nazi playbook, I mean, they're identifying like this external threat that they can mobilize the reactionary elements of the population against. The immigrants are like I said before, that's like a big thing for far right and fascist movements to mobilize around post World War II is the question of immigration. So I mean, they could, you know, they're like mobilizing their base to attack this so-called external enemy. And I mean, that's just like, it is right out of the Nazi playbook. And but I, like I mentioned, I think like you have a really strong I think Latino move, social movement in the U.S. And so I think they've had a strong response. And I think there's a lot of things that the Trump regime would like to do, but they're not able to do because they have to be concerned of the response that it's going to create, you know. So I think there is the social movements are keeping a lot of the worst aspects of the Trump regime in check, I think. So again, I mean, I think that's pretty hopeful. And plus, you just have such a different, like I mentioned before, you just have such a different social dynamic because you do have really strong Latino communities in the United States.
Right.
And, like, they're going to have to, I mean, this is why the white supremacists in the U.S., you know, back in the 70s and that, there was a movement among them that identified an area of the United States that had a majority white population.
Right.
And that's the Pacific Northwest. So their idea was to create a homeland there. The Aryan Nations was a big part of promoting that. Because their thing is, like that's their part of their position, is like they're not going to have a white America. There's no way they can have a white America because white America, it's not a strong thing. Like it's not as it once was before, maybe, you know, pre-World War II. Because now you have a much more diverse population. There are large areas of Latino and Black populations and stuff like that. So that's why I think that, you know, that's why this idea arose that we'll have this little white homeland in the Pacific Northwest, and the rest of the country is just kind of like, you know, that's not going to be, you know, that's not for us. We're just going to try to take this one thing. But that's what I was saying, like with the Proud Boys and that, like you might have like a different type of fascist movement arise, like or fascist kind of ideologies arise that are more multinational. It might become like super patriotic American, which is what you see with the Proud Boys and Patriot Prayer.
Yeah, we would describe it as like a whiteness that's open for everybody, you know, as long as you can kind of get down with the program.
Yeah, as long as you accept the white supremacy, you're welcome to join our group, right? Which is like what a lot of those Black and Latino guys who are involved with Proud Boys and like that, you know, they probably accept a lot of this, what is white supremacy, but, you know, they may not see it as such, but, you know, America, this is the way things are supposed to be, our traditional values and all this, the conservative values and stuff like that, the Constitution and all this type of stuff, that's what they're into. But, yeah, I mean, yeah, it's hard to say what people should do, because in one sense, people are doing a lot already, and I think they're actually having some success with it.
Yeah. Well, that kind of brings us to our next question. I mean, in the coming months and years, you know, what do you think revolutionary anti-fascists should have in mind? And also just, you know, I would throw out there too, like, I don't know, I mean, everybody on the show has a different feeling that Trump is going to get reelected or he's not. I'm curious your thoughts, you know, if and when Trump leaves the stage of history, whether he's voted out, whether he's thrown out by a popular movement, or, you know, different factions of the elites kind of like say, now's the time to go, Don. You know, what do you think is going to happen to that base? Will it just kind of flounder into different factions?
It's hard to say, man, but you have some experience in the 50s with, you know, state governors who were like completely racist and supported the KKK and stuff.
Right.
So you have something that you can look at to see what happened in those states. But I think with Trump, I mean, I would be surprised if he got reelected. But it's really hard to tell because it's so unpredictable. I mean, he's been smeared so much with this Russia stuff and just his narcissism and his mental illness that I think a lot of people have come to see. I've seen he's got some of the highest disapproval ratings that he's ever had now. And so I would be surprised if he got reelected. But either way, I think his legacy is going to be that these fascist and far right movements that he really energized, that they're going to be here after he's gone, after he leaves the stage. These groups are still going to be here because they seem to have found a resonance among the white racist elements of the population, that it's not just going to disappear. But I think, there might be, I don't know too much about all the politics and that, but things like the Redneck Revolt, that type of idea of going into these white working class communities and trying to organize them, right? Like, that's important. And that's what anti-fascist action in Britain had some success doing. And they identified that this is what we have to do, is get in there with the white working class and get them into the anti-fascist movement so they don't join the fascists. And they butted heads with the more liberal anti-racist groups who were like, we have to go into black communities and talk to them and get them on into our groups and stuff like that. Because anti-fascist action, I mean, they were mostly like white guys, but they're like, they couldn't really do that, and that wasn't their thing, and they didn't see that as being the most important strategy because they're not addressing where the threat is coming from. Because the black communities are probably pretty much going to be anti-fascist, right, when they have fascist mobs attacking their homes with firebombs and stuff like that. So I think, that might be something that people should consider too, is like, how do we undermine the fascist expansion into the white working class communities? That might be something that is important to consider. Because even though we identify fascist movements largely as a middle class reactionary movement, they do have a strong proletarian participation, and it's primarily in the militias, the paramilitary groupings. In Nazi Germany, the brown shirts were the most proletarian of the Nazi party.
Right.
And probably the same with Italy too. So that's why that element needs to be targeted with anti-fascist propaganda and whatnot, so that they don't turn to the fascists. And the other thing about the fascist thing is, like, when they take the streets, they're trying to project an image of power, that they can take the streets and they can walk through the streets, and despite any resistance, that they're strong enough. And that's what the danger with that Patriot Prayer and Proud Boys activities in Oregon and Washington State is, because they've had actually fairly strong street mobilizations. And that type of thing is what recruits the weak white working class kids into their movements, because they see them as being strong, and that's what attracts them. So you see with Patriot Prayer, when they went down to Portland for one of their last big rallies, a lot of their kids came from rural Washington State. They're these white kids. And so that's the type of areas that anti-fascist, anti-racist culture has to permeate into to stop them from being able to recruit from those areas.
Yeah.
Some of my thoughts.
Well, those are all good thoughts. And I mean, the good news is that there is, like, we've had people from Redneck Revolt on that have talked about, like, counter-recruiting in militia circles, people going to gun shows. I absolutely agree. I mean, we've got to, like, split, like, the people that are, like, that kind of side with Trump over, quote, economic issues, from, like, the kind of, like, people that make, like, $100,000 a year but really just like Trump because he hates immigrants. Like, I think that kind of class line has to really be drawn. And I mean, I don't know, after 2 years of Trump, how anybody can look at him and say that he's, like, helping, the struggling, forgotten Americans. I mean, if anything,
it's almost like the classic fascist movement. There's a cult of personality that's been built up around Trump. And so you have this cult following that no matter what is said about him or what he does, they see him as being incapable of doing any wrong. He's like a poor man's fascist dictator. Like, he can't really pull it off, but he pulls it off enough that his base will always support him no matter what he does, because they just see it as, how he attacks the media all the time because the media is reporting on all his stupid stuff he does. And then so then people are like, oh, well, the media is the enemy of the people now. They started adopting this stuff. The same thing that Hitler did, he attacked the press because they're exposing all his, the barbaric nature of Nazi politics and whatnot. So it is like a cult of personality that's been built up around him. And it's
But at the same time, like, the Nazis did try to, like, offer – you know, the German people kind of like a new deal, so to speak, or give them things, whereas Trump is just like, well, maybe you can get a job as a Border Patrol agent or building a pipeline. I mean, other than that, you're fucked, you know? Like, there hasn't – it seems like they haven't really gone out of their way to do anything. You know, it's like – for instance, like all this talk about coal, even the Trump administration's like own like projections and research that they published have said that they're – their own like cutting back of regulations about coal will kill like over 1,000 people over the next year or something like that. So,
right.
You know, it's just,
well, he's giving them the anti-immigrant rhetoric and actions. That's a big part of, I think, his appeal to them. He's reinforcing in like the white supremacist idea of what America is. So that's something that he gives to them as well, because a lot of it's just like the psychological thing, I think. You know, you got white redneck kids living in poverty, but they think Trump is the greatest, and they think he's really about the people and stuff like that. So there's a lot of like fake manipulations and stuff going on that people are just buying into, but it just goes back to their, I think, this white supremacy thing. Like, they can't stand the idea that there's this Black Lives Matter, like they're complaining about getting shot by cops and stuff like that, and then there's all these illegal immigrants in the country, and yeah, it's just a completely reactionary movement, and it's like Trump doesn't anything more than what he's giving them in terms of like racist rhetoric and that. They feel emboldened, they feel empowered, they feel like he's the only one who talks real and says things the way that they are, that type of stuff. Because, I mean, you know, you've just never seen neo-Nazis supporting a presidential candidate like you did with Trump. And I think they saw the potential of what Trump would be with his rhetoric and stuff like that. So,
yeah.
And, I mean, in the Nazis in Germany, they were offering stuff, but it was like, they couldn't really do much of the Nazi Party until they got into power. So it wasn't like they were really... And once they got into power, I mean, their main thing was like, we're going to prepare for a world war. And that was the big part of what drove the German economy once the Nazis took power. It was just gearing up for war. War production, arms production, military recruitment, and stuff like that. So, I mean, that could be a potential scenario with Trump or something. It's just another big war somewhere, but it's a different time though, because I don't think the U.S. population is very supportive of wars in a sense, because like they're tired. They still have the Vietnam syndrome. That's what's really, that's limited U.S. involved in wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and stuff like that. So, I think it's hard for him to actually, and I think it's really confusing what he's doing with all these terrorists and stuff like that. You know, the American economy, I think a lot of people are really concerned about what he's doing, other than his base. You know, they support everything he does, but I think a lot of people who voted for Trump are really wondering, like, what is he doing? And they're concerned about his impact on the economy and America's reputation around the world and stuff like that. That's why I think, like, I would be so surprised if he got reelected, just because of how he's conducted himself.
He's
just such an incompetent person. Like, he's mentally ill. Not that Hitler wasn't mentally ill, but, I mean, Hitler presented himself as a strong man, and he was able to project strength. But Trump doesn't. He's just, like, so incompetent at his job. Like, I don't see how people could feel empowered by him except the most fanatical, diehard Trump fans, you know?
Well, it's kind of a dual thing, which kind of runs the gamut of the far right. It's like both strength, but also like I'm always the victim. But yeah, I wanted to turn now, you know, last big question. You know, in terms of Native and Indigenous struggles happening in so-called Canada, is there anything, you know, any shout outs or anything you want to talk about? I mean, there's a lot going on. You know, which would require obviously its own podcast in itself. But anything that you kind of want to talk about or kind of want to highlight to people?
No, not really, not right now. Yeah, I've been so focused on the anti-fascist stuff right now, and then this just doing work, this struggling with my own financial situation and that. But I mean, there's definitely been a big mobilizing of Indigenous people since the since like 2011, 2012 or so. And I think there's a lot more kind of activist type of work among Indigenous peoples now. And we'll just have to see how it plays out over time. Because I mean, a lot of it's like been focused on oil and gas for the last few years. So I think like with this Kinder Morgan Trans Mountain pipeline expansion, I think this is kind of like a big battle that people have been anticipating for years, because the Enbridge pipeline was canceled, you know, largely, I think, due to the potential threat that Indigenous peoples pose, because they were so opposed to that pipeline. But this pipeline is kind of going in a different way. But now we just had this court decision that stopped construction of the pipeline. But it's been a very legalistic struggle for the most part, you know. So it's for me, it's not really contributing so much to a grassroots Indigenous resistance. It's more kind of like, yeah, just the legalistic, almost like an NGO type approach to this anti-pipeline campaigns. But yeah, like you said, there'd be a lot to talk about.
Yeah. Well. For people that enjoy this podcast, I mean, you know, again, you know, It's Going Down, you know, is very indebted to all the work that you've done over the years and definitely all the contributions you've made to various, you know, currents. If people are interested in finding more about your work, like your books or comics or anything, where should they go to pick them up?
Well, to pick them up, I mean, Arsenal Pulp Press, they got a website. They do mail order and stuff like that. Also, on the books on Amazon and stuff like that. I have my own website that people can check out at warriorpublications.wordpress.com, where I have a lot of articles and like documents, like the counter surveillance documents and stuff like that. It's mostly just reposting of corporate news articles, but you can get information, other information there as well. But yeah, I'd encourage people to check out the Antifa comic book. And I'll be doing a tour this fall, going out east and then down the west coast. So,
oh, awesome. In, you're coming to the U.S.?
Come check out. What's that?
You're coming to the U.S.?
Yeah, I have dates set for Seattle, Olympia, and Portland.
Okay.
Later in October.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, hey, thanks so much for talking to us.
No, thanks for doing the interview with me.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us. And follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.